Hi, I'm Jane Whitney. Welcome to the Common Ground Podcast. On every episode, we bring together diverse voices from across the nation to discuss the most pressing and controversial issues of our time, issues that make a difference in your life. On June 27th, a diverse panel of experts on racism gave us their candid analysis of where we stand in the fight for equality and justice. A year ago, George Floyd's six-year-old daughter Gianna proclaimed that her daddy had changed the world. And last summer's protests played out against a counterpoint of hope that this time might actually be different, a catalyst for real change in the struggle for racial equality. Today, we'll explore what has changed and what hasn't in the years since George Floyd died. Here to help us do that is a panel of distinguished and diverse voices. Joining us are Jelani Cobb, historian and staff writer for The New Yorker, Don Lemon, CNN anchor and best-selling author of This Is the Fire, Richard Louie, NBC and MSNBC anchor and author of Enough About Me, and Heather McGee, author of the New York Times bestseller, The Sum of Us. We are so grateful to have all of you with us. And Don, I'm going to start with you. A year ago, there really was such energy and such optimism that this was going to be an inflection point, that things were really going to be different this time around. How do you think that promise has played out?
Well, I think, Jane, first of all, I'd like to say that I'm very honored to be here with you and with the other panelists, with Jelani, with Richard, and with Heather. Thank you so much. I'm indeed honored. This is a very distinguished group. How has it played out? I think it's honestly, for me, I think it's yet to be seen. I remain optimistic and hopeful, but as all of you are, and I am as well, paying attention to the news, we see the interest in these sorts of issues, Black Lives Matter, George Floyd, to be specific, we see that interest waning. We see the polling showing there was strong interest in change and police reform. Initially when George Floyd was murdered, and then now afterwards, we don't see that same sort of interest. The polling shows that it's lower. So I think that we have made change. We've made progress. I am optimistic, but I'm realistic about that optimism.
In the New York Times review of your book, This Is the Fire, you were quoted as saying that watching the footage of George Floyd being killed was really like watching yourself being killed in a way. It was this insensibly sluggish, was the phrase I think you used, murder that you could see yourself being killed. Can you talk about that for a minute?
Well, I think we all saw ourselves. I think more so, Jane, I saw myself in that. But more than anything, I was imagining not really me on the ground there, but I was imagining my great nephew, which is who I started the book out writing about, a letter to my great nephew. I could see my brother-in-law. I could see my dad, my uncle, my cousin, and then me. And so, I did see myself, but I saw, quite honestly, others around me. Even it could have been my father if my dad was still alive, and with no autonomy, with no agency, with no authority, just at the hands of a police officer having someone's life literally and figuratively and physically snuffed out of them as everyone watched from, you know, the sidewalk helpless.
Along those lines, Jonathan Capehart from the Washington Post wrote a piece called Being Black in America is Exhausting. And he talked about the fact that it doesn't matter what your gender, what your socioeconomic background is, what your age is. Black people are seen, people of color are seen as a threat. They're a risk. And as a result, you live every day with that sort of backdrop. Now, somebody would look at you and say, well, no, that doesn't affect him in the same way. Does it affect you in the same way?
Well, listen, I have to say that I have the great blessing and fortune and gift, whatever that means, of timing or luck or from God or whatever it is, to be in the position that I'm in, to be able to have a national, quite frankly, an international platform. So I have a platform and I think a privilege that most people of color in our society don't have. But just because I have that, because I am one of a few or an exception, it doesn't mean that I can't understand or that I haven't been there, because I've certainly lived it and I live it every single day. And as I write in the book, Jane, I say that I believe that Black people specifically live in sort of like we're running a race. And when you get ready to run a race, it's ready, and then you set, and then go. So as I write in the book, we live in the set. And whether we're experiencing actual racism or it is perceived, it is this paranoia that we have to live in all the time, and not because we want to do it, because society has put us in that place. So whether it is or it isn't, we still have to live with that paranoia. And so, you know, I write about instances in the book where I've experienced discrimination, and I write about instances where I'm not sure that I've experienced discrimination. But for the mindset is the same, how you hold your body, how it is, how your body receives it, is all the same way, whether it is real or not. And that's not because of anything that I've done. It's because of what society has done. It's because of growing up in America. It's because of the history of this country.
You, in your book, do start out by writing a letter to your nephew, Trushad, and you end the letter by saying, silence is not an option. And you certainly live those words, because you're out there. Somebody, I don't know who it was, called you an openly Black voice. I mean, you're out there calling out Congressman Glenn Grothman when he says that Black Lives Matter doesn't like the old-fashioned family, or when Senator Tim Scott says that being woke or woke supremacy is as bad as white supremacy. You're out there. Was there a conscious moment for you when you decided you were not going to hold back? There was going to be no plumber's trap. You were basically going to just tell people what you thought.
Well, I don't know if there was a certain moment. I think there was over time. Listen, over time, I think people evolve. I mean, I'm not the same person I was yesterday or a minute ago or, you know, 10 years or 5 years ago. So I think that I certainly have become more comfortable and more authoritative in my position and in my platform. But I also think that as I mature as an adult and as someone who is in the world and who is at the matrix of what almost every issue that happens in this country, especially every single night, that I have a certain authority and a certain knowledge. I'm steeped in the knowledge that many people aren't. No, I'm able to give my point of view and to talk about it. Does that mean that I'm always what right? No. But here's the thing. I think people who are on other networks like a Sean Hannity or a Tucker Carlson or whenever it was, or Bill O'Reilly or whomever it is, or Joe Scarborough or Lawrence O'Donnell, they can speak to the issues as white men and are not criticized for it and are not demonized for it. So therefore, I, as a Black man who happens to be the only one in prime time, I feel that I have the authority and the right as an American to be able to do the same thing. And if I don't do it, who else will be able to do it? In 2018, my sister died suddenly in January of 2018. No warning, nothing, an accidental drowning. So that gave me an urgency that I didn't have before. No day is promised. No moment is promised. No second is promised. So what am I going to do with the voice and with the platform that I have now? As I write in the book, this is my moment. This was my moment. What did I choose to say? This was the moment. What did I choose to do? And so I cannot go to my grave looking back with a regret that I didn't do enough or that I went along to get along. That's not going to happen for me. So I'm certainly going to speak the truth, especially as a Black man in this society. And guess what? I don't really care what people have to say about it, because I'm speaking the truth and I'm going to continue to do it.
Last question. I'm sorry we're out of time. I have like 50 questions here for you, but you'll have to come back. Okay.
Yeah.
Last question. This black and white seems to be a theme that runs through your entire life. You're Black. Your fiance, Tim, is white. You have two dogs, I understand. One is white, one is Black. You're on this mission to try and... Oh, you have three now? Oh, yep. New information.
Yep. During COVID, we fostered a dog during COVID, and the dog... How do you send a dog back?
But you're also on this mission to try and foster greater understanding, raise consciousness, however you want to call it. You've said you're optimistic. What is there something you still want to do to really try and make a difference in this arena?
That's a very good question. Is there something I really want to do? Yes, always. I want to get people to understand that the only way we're going to make a difference in the world is to have relationships with each other. And whether it's comfortable or not, hopefully it's uncomfortable, because that's the only time that you really make a difference. So what I try to do in my personal life off of television, Jane, is foster relationships with people who don't look like me, who don't think like me, who come from different backgrounds, who are completely opposite, different regions of the country. I want to foster understanding and acceptance. And I think in this moment that we absolutely need to hold people to account. They need to be held accountable. But we also need to give people grace in this moment to understand each other, to have conversations that are uncomfortable, to make mistakes in those conversations, and to explain to them why I am feeling the way I feel, why they feel the way they feel, and why an awkward moment or word or action doesn't have to be the end of someone. It can be possibly the beginning of an understanding and an evolution for this country.
And on that note, giving people grace sounds like a title of a book. I don't know, just a thought. Don Lemon, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. And on that note, Don just set up the next part of the broadcast. And Richard, we're actually going to start with you, because part of the focus today has to do with Asian American Pacific Islander hatred and racism, and the fact that hate crimes against those folks have spiked in the last year during the pandemic. It's like 145%. We have a video question from somebody that goes to why the surge in those numbers. And let's take a look at that right now.
Hi, I'm Shana To from Singapore. Branding COVID-19 the China virus was like throwing gasoline onto the fire of Asian American hatred that's been smoldering for years. Why is there such a receptive climate for anti-Asian discrimination?
It's a big question, Richard. What's the answer?
Well, I don't know if I got the answer. Jane, thanks for having us. First of all, it's great to see Don join us and be at the top of the program. Good to see Jelani and Heather as well, and looking into digging into all of this in what I hope is an intersectional way. And I guess I'll start with this, Jane, very quickly, and to say that I guess the answer is a little bit bigger than actually the specifics of the question. And I think that what Don started out by describing to us, which is a broader opportunity and a big problem, one that as a reporter, you know, my first story as a Cub reporter, Jane, was Rodney King. I'm a Californian. I got my first job at Calex. And for the first time, we had video of a Black man being beaten. And then I stood in the streets of Ferguson, Missouri. And then I went to Baltimore, Maryland. And then let's bring it forward, standing in Brooklyn for George Floyd, when we see 6,600 self-reported incidents in a year after March 2020, it's the same shade of the same ugliness as why is it happening now? The issue is, it's been here for a long time, Jane. You and I both know, all of us know this on this panel.
Dr. Leanna Wen actually talked about the fact that this is really just a new chapter in a very sad old story. And that has to do with Asian immigrants being seen as the yellow peril, that they were blamed for smallpox, they were blamed for tuberculosis, now they've been blamed for COVID. What is this pervasive stereotype that makes Asian Americans sort of vulnerable to being scapegoated during these times of tumult?
The view of who they are is the ultimate other, the ultimate not from here people. And the questions that are often asked to underline it, which are microaggressions, are where are you from? Where are you really from? And that idea of the model minority, which has been used not just from the 1960s when it was first termed, it's been used since the beginning of the formation of our great union, going back 200, 400 years of this idea of model. Because model means what? Good. So is there a good minority? And Asian Americans being called the model minority means that the perception is that they're the good ones, but that's a bigger problem with that very idea, that there is a bad minority. And there was no such thing as a bad minority, zero. And if there is a good minority, for 2 seconds here, Jane, then that might mean, well, you get all the good stuff, right? you get the promotions, you get the high paying, and you get treated like a human being. Well, why is it that we have so many hate incidents in the last year then, if this group is supposedly, you know, the good minority? But all in all, I think the big opportunity for the 94% of America, there's 6% Asian American Pacific Islanders, is for us to embrace the idea of model minority so that we can reject it.
You've kind of set up the next question, which is going to Heather. Heather, the premise of your book, The Sum of Us, is that racism, we all pay a price for racism. And I mentioned this to a couple of people and they looked at me like, what are you talking about? It's a concept that seems so simple and obvious, but it's not. So could you explain what the concept is?
You know, when I set out to write The Sum of Us, I knew that I was taking what had been an issue that we've talked about for so long and turning it on its head a little bit and asking questions about the flip side. You know, in many ways, racism, the way of seeing the world through a racial hierarchical worldview, really sets up a zero sum. This idea that progress for one group has to come at the expense of others, the idea that, you know, if I win, you lose, if I get a job, you lose yours. This is this zero-sum racial hierarchy. Every advantage for white Americans mirrored by disadvantage for people of color. And yet, ultimately, if that's the paradigm that we seek to uproot, then don't we need to make sure that we are zooming out and seeing how that paradigm might also be embedded in some of the stories we tell as racial justice advocates? And so that was the sort of controversial question that I set out to answer in The Sum of Us. Now, as a person whose background is 20 years in economic policy, you know, I had some hunches, right? I knew that, for example, just last summer, Citigroup calculated that the racial economic divides between Black and white families around income, wealth, business investments were costing the overall economic growth of our society $16 trillion over the last 20 years. And that if we closed those economic gaps today, our economy would be $5 trillion larger in the next few years. So on an economic basis, it's clear that if you have so many of your players on the sidelines saddled by debt, discrimination, and disadvantage because of explicitly racist policies and racist systems that have been set up and haven't been reformed, then you aren't going to have as many of those players on your field scoring points for your team. And yet the fallacy that has been really the lie at the heart of America from our founding has been that we are not on the same team and that some part of our population can profit at the expense of others inevitably and throughout time. And I just reject that.
You hit on something, though, the fact that we're steeped in this zero sum game mentality that it's at the heart of U.S. history. And that really sort of in the simplest terms brings it down to somebody's winning and somebody's losing. And how do you break through that mentality?
Well, you know, I'm an economic policy person, and so I wanted to gather the numbers, right? I wanted to make a case that we don't always make when we're talking about an issue that is quite emotional and personal, spiritual even, which is the dehumanization of so many of our people, which I would argue, and many more brilliant people than I have argued, dehumanizes everyone involved, including the oppressor. You know, we so often talk about it in those terms, and yet I wanted to bring some cold, hard numbers. And I think in the response to the book, you've seen that some people, you know, a lot of folks in the financial sector, a lot of folks who see the world through economic terms, who think, well, I'm socially liberal, but I'm fiscally conservative, right? Which is, you know, I think something, a term I talk about in the book that needs to be unpacked and really explored. But I think every American is asking, whatever ideological stripe, what is wrong? Why can't we get it together? Why can't we invest in one another? Why can't we come up with common solutions to our common problems? And this racial division, the scapegoating in our politics and our policymaking is a core answer.
Jelani, I have a big assignment for you right now because I'm going to ask you to explain critical race theory and why folks like Florida Governor Ron DeSantis say that it teaches kids to hate their country, it teaches kids to hate each other. Can you explain what this controversy is about?
Sure. Critical race theory is an outgrowth of the thinking of a number of legal scholars in the 1970s, 1980s. Preeminent among them was the late legal scholar Derrick Bell, in an attempt to understand how, after the victories of the civil rights movement, legislatively, but specifically the victories in terms of litigation at the civil rights movement in the civil rights era, had not yielded societal equality, how there was still deeply rooted inequality in American society that became apparent as early as the decade after the civil rights movement had ended. And so if we're looking at those questions, we then have to ask about our systems and our structures, our criminal justice system, our housing policies, our employment institutions, our healthcare institutions, every kind of major institution that impacts American life, and as well as, you know, the legal system. And so that's what critical race theory was really attempting to understand, and what had been the shortcomings and what had been the problems that people had overlooked in the course of the civil rights movement that allowed this pathogen of inequality to mutate and continue to infect the body politic. Has nothing to do with white people, has nothing to do with hating white people, has nothing to do with your contempt for any particular group. The really exasperated and indignant demands that critical race theory not be taught to 10-year-olds. If your child was learning critical race theory at 10 years old, you should really be very proud because it means that kid is a genius and was in law school.
You've written about the fact that the Republican Party, you think is suppressing Black history, your history, the real history, and basically that they're defending voter suppression because they say that we're not a racist country. I mean, we've heard numerous people say that on the record, and isn't this all part of the same issue?
Well, first, I'll say I don't think it's simply Republicans that are suppressing, the true history of this country. If that were the case, we'd probably be better off than we are now. I think there's a kind of general consensus that we don't like dealing with ugly or painful parts of our past. And we do so reluctantly and with a great many attempts to minimize or to contextualize or to drown by means of nuance what actually happens in this country. And so I think that's one part of it. The other part of it, though, is that we saw millions of people look at that video of George Floyd last year and go in search of answers. And much to their credit, people wanted to understand the context. How was it possible for this man to die in the manner that he did in public on the corner of South 38th and Chicago Avenue in Minneapolis? And that quest translated into interest in these broader histories. And in addition to that, translated into some degree of support for the Democratic ticket that year, that election year. And so what we're seeing is really an attempt to curtail the chain of reasoning and the body of knowledge and scholarship that allowed people to draw the conclusion that our problems were much bigger than a single incident on a single day, on a single Memorial Day in a single American city. And so I think that's what's at the heart of this here.
Richard, I want to go back to a comment you made about the AAPI community when you called them a model minority. And basically, you're on the record when you were talking about your own awakening as an Asian American as saying that the AAPI community is tired of the xenophobia and the pain and the discrimination that they have suffered for centuries, for decades in this country. And you feel that we're really at a watershed moment for them to break out in some way. Can you explain that?
for the AAPI community, there are very few tentpoles in its civil rights history in terms of a response. One, and I'm talking about a civil rights response. On June 23rd, the 39th anniversary of the killing of one Asian American Pacific Islander man, Vincent Chin. Now, it's just one person, but I'm reflecting more on the civil rights response for an AAPI civil rights moment. That was the only time we saw marches in the street, and there weren't a lot. And now, as we have lived through the last year, the watershed moment, which we don't know the answer to in terms of whether it will or will not be, is that we must put the tent pole up. Where will the March on Washington be for this community and all communities? A unity march. When will that be, and how will it look like? What might a museum look like that reflects the contributions of an AAPI community that has been here for so long and proudly has contributed to the beauty of what we do every day? You know, one of the numbers that I think of, and I was looking through the census with my team, and on this, Jane, I looked at the last calendar year where we had 6,600 reported incidents of hate crimes or hate incidents, and there were 200,000 babies born that look like me in the last year. And for that community, 10 years from now, when those babies are 10 years old and they crack open their maybe their first, you know, in-depth history book, the important point is that we must put another tent pole.
Can I add something?
Yes, Jelani, go ahead, please.
You know, Richard brings up some really great points here. And I think that, you know, since we've had this conversation about history, you know, there are things that we don't know and things that within the things that we don't know, even more things that we don't know. I mean, layers of knowledge that we're missing. We don't really even teach the fact that there were Chinese who were lynched in this country. Huge lynchings in Los Angeles in the 1870s. There's a history of violence directed at the Asian community that's centuries deep. You know, that goes, you know, very deep into the history of this country. And even when we look at the kind of dynamics, especially the dynamics that Richard was talking about, you know, when we teach, you know, African-American history, there's a Supreme Court justice who looms, you know, greatly, Justice John Marshall Harlan, who was famous for dissenting in two major cases, the most notable of them being Plessy versus Ferguson. But what people don't talk about in that within those dissents is the fact that Harlan protested against Black people being denied their rights by saying, if we're going to deny anyone their rights, it should be the Chinese. And so we should give, and it's this constant kind of thing to tie this into Heather's point, this constant kind of idea of zero-sum realities, being that if we're going to enfranchise this community, we can do it at the expense of the other community. And, you know, one of the kind of heroic voices you hear in this moment for this reason and lots of other reasons is Frederick Douglass, you know, the abolitionist, the escaped slave, who wrote very passionately and very brilliantly, as he did, you know, in most things that he wrote, about the need to recognize the humanity of the Chinese immigrant community, which was overwhelmingly a labor community on the West Coast of the country, and saying that anything that you think human beings want, if you can understand what human beings want, then this is what that community wants. And if anything that you think are virtues among human beings, you will find as virtues within this community. And so I think that just to tie in everyone's point, ultimately, what we are actually working for, what we're saying that we want here, is democracy. And I think that's what is at the essence, kind of undergirding all of these different questions and conversations that we're having here.
I do want to take a moment to go through and get a sense of variables that have shaped your particular worldview. And I'm going to start with Heather, because we have a video question for you that goes to some of the challenges or basically, when you were younger. We're going to talk about that. Here's that video question.
Hi, I'm Caroline Consolving, and I'm very proud to say that I was Heather's dorm mate in high school. Heather, thank you for writing such an incredible, important book. I wanted to ask you how your experience at our high school informed your work today.
After your book came out, you did a program at your high school, and you were very candid about the challenges you faced as a young person, young adult. And would you just share some of that right now?
Sure. I had pretty much every kind of educational experience you can have, right? Everywhere on the spectrum of segregation to integration, you know, being born in a neighborhood that was 98% Black, living in one of the most integrated suburbs in the country, going to law school, you know, post an affirmative action ban where there were four times as many Asian Americans as there were African Americans, and where, you know, when I first heard about it, obviously the year afterwards, there was just one African American student, and going to a high school, which was a boarding school far away from where I was born on the south side of Chicago, that was, you know, not just white, but, you know, quintessentially privileged Northeastern WASP culture that I really had no idea about. That was, couldn't have been more different from the culture that I was born into in so many ways. And so I think that gave me a perspective about people's common humanity, right? I mean, when you're a young person, there are all these obvious layers, right? People are clearly very different. Their opportunities, the what's in their fridge, you know, how they talk to their parents, their expectations of the world. And yet at the same time, I was never taught to really associate what someone had with what they were worth and how good they were. Because I knew truly extraordinary people who had nothing financially, you know, and the inverse. And so I think that helped me not be too impressed by wealth and by privilege, and also understand that it was a rarity, and that and it helped me always ask the questions about why, right? Why is it that you know, people who ultimately, you know, and I just didn't believe the people are great because, you know, rich people are sort of better, right? I just didn't believe that. I didn't see it. It wasn't born out. And so I needed a different explanation for why people in the neighborhood where I was born, you know, struggled so much, worked so hard and struggled so much. And so that question about why, about privilege and wealth, really did drive me into my career in economic policy. So I think that shaped me a lot. We are a nation that will soon be a country with no racial majority. We are a nation populated by ancestral strangers who have, you know, there's someone here with a tie to every community on the globe. And as I write in The Sum of Us, I do believe that that diversity can be our superpower. Now, that is in direct odds with the ways in which racism has held the pen, as we've written so many of the laws that parcel out opportunity in this country. The ways in which, as I write in my book, when we created the great middle class, when we invented the American dream, that was on the back of trillions of dollars of free handouts, free stuff, right? Of government largesse to a teeming working class of people who never dreamed of having the kind of economic security that the New Deal and the post-war economic consensus delivered with basically no strings attached. And most of that economic largesse, most of those public goods, public amenities, public protections, whether it was Social Security or massive investments in housing, the creation of the affordable mortgage, the GI Bill, were all exclusive, racially segregated, and excluded Black people, either and many other people of color, either explicitly, as with the you know, incredibly important wealth building adventure that was the creation of mass home ownership, or not necessarily through intent, because the GI Bill was race neutral on its face, but where the public benefits were filtered through segregated housing and higher education markets, you had that racial exclusion.
Jelani, you were the correspondent on an award-winning frontline program called Policing the Police, which was done, I think, in the wake of the George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, the killings of Black people. And I think you shot it in Newark, yes, if I'm correct. You basically, though, also you were talking about yourself a little bit in that broadcast, and you talked about your first experience with the police. Tell us what happened.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll come back in a second. I want to kind of respond to what Heather said about the kind of cultural differences that she saw, you know, what people had, what people didn't have, you know, what was in people's refrigerators. And, you know, my marker as a young person was always that I grew up in a kind of working class to working poor family. And my objective was to make enough money to have things in my refrigerator that I mispronounced. And so I'm now happily able to say that, you know, I don't know how to say half the stuff that's in my refrigerator right now. So,
so you've arrived. You know, that's terrific. Congratulations.
Yeah. So, right. You know, come over. Exactly. I'll cook you something. I just can't tell you what exactly it is. And so
it's okay.
So I will say this, though, you know, as a young person, my interaction, you know, with institutions kind of gave me a sense of, you know, the dynamics of like what my parents were trying to explain to me. Both my parents migrated to New York from the Deep South. My mother from Alabama. She was from Bessemer, which is a community just outside of Birmingham. And my father, who was from a town called Hazelhurst, Georgia, which was so small that if you'd heard of it, it meant you were my cousin. And so he came from there to New York. And it had this very practical, realistic sense of what the world was. They believed that there was more opportunity in the North, but they also did not believe that we had somehow or another slipped into a racial promised land. And so my interactions with, you know, police and my interactions in the educational system, unfortunately, where, you know, because I'm a 6'3" black man, I stopped growing when I was 15, people had a very pronounced sense of who I was and what my intellectual capabilities were just based upon the package that I came in. And, you know, I had those experiences. I had the experiences of police stopping me in uniform, coming from a baseball game that I just played, stopping me and frisking me on a mailbox as a 15-year-old. And so I kind of was getting these lessons from my parents, or these things that my parents were saying, which were kind of abstract, but they were being made real by my experiences in the world. You know, that said, I also have to say that if there's a bigger beneficiary of the New York City public school system, I would like to meet that person. Because by and large, you know, I was fortunate enough to have the majority of my teachers be decent, honorable people who really did invest in trying to teach me things that would be useful and helpful to me as I move through the world. And that is what has driven our work, to try to fight to make sure that other people, irrespective of what they look like, irrespective of where they come from, irrespective, to Heather's point, you know, what's in their refrigerator, that those people have the same sorts of opportunities and that we invest in ways that make a more equitable society. And so that has been, you know, really the foundation as a young person, foundation for the work that I did. And, you know, in Newark and in other places, I think too many cities to count right now where I've been writing about policing and other failing institutions as they relate to race.
Richard, I was surprised to learn by your own admission when you were younger, you were, by, again, you called yourself this, an ugly American, that you actually in high school would mock the new Asian immigrant kids who were coming into your school. What was that about?
It's about wanting to be white. I wanted to be accepted. Anybody who was a new immigrant to our great country, if I would make fun of how they smelled or the food they ate. Well, look at me. I was also that kid when I was growing up. But the embarrassing thing for me about that, Jane, was, you know, my grandfather, he came to the country because he didn't want me to be a poor Chinese farmer. He's from the south of China, and he came here in his teens. And he luckily was able to become a barber in San Francisco. He knew nothing about cutting hair. But that's our great dream, right? We can recreate ourselves in the country. And the one thing I discovered when I was 15 is that my grandfather had come to the country illegally, that he had actually bought the name Louis, L-U-I. His real last name was Wong. And he had done so for that very idea, because there was an exclusion act, that first of our country, that said, if you come from China, if you're Chinese and you're not wealthy, well, don't come. You cannot come, you cannot enter this, a Chinese Exclusion Act. That was why he had to buy the name to come here. And so my real last name is Wong. I'm actually Richard Wong. And when I found out, it was when my grandmother was being buried, because her tombstone said Wong. And I actually looked at my dad and I said, I know we're cheap. We didn't buy a used tombstone, did we? Because that's the wrong name on that tombstone. He didn't know either. And he was 40 something. So he went to talk to his oldest sister, their 13 siblings. And she said, yeah, Stephen, your father and your mother came to this country illegally and they took it to their grave. If you go and you look at tombstones that might have Asian writing on it or Chinese writing on it and English, it is often their real name in Chinese and their fake name in English. That very dynamic was like, exactly, Jelani. I was like, wow, like that is the reality. And so when I reflected on what I did later in high school, you can see the pain and the embarrassment I had as a 20-something-year-old later in life when I realized I was rejecting my grandfather. I was rejecting that courage, that dream of what we have for the world by making fun of them. I have forever apologized for being that way. But I was that ugly American. And I was that ugly American to my grandfather by saying those things to them. So now instead I say to my grandfather, even though I never met him, is thank you for coming to this country. I don't agree with breaking the law. We got laws for a reason. But I thank you for coming here because your grandson is now a national news anchor. How about that? Your dream came true.
Thank you. Thank you for telling that story. Jelani, I want to ask you, we're sort of winding down at this point, and we tend to talk about how we can make things better going forward in this last segment. And I want to talk about your father, who Willie Lee, who had, I think, a third grade education and gave you the invaluable, precious gift of teaching you to read. This last video question goes to a form of education, and I'd like you to address it on the other side. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Tyrell Brown from Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love and sisterly affection. And my question to the panel is, what can be done to better educate Americans on a consistent basis about the depth and range of Black perspectives? Thank you.
Jelani, you're also a professor at the Columbia University Journalism School. So how would you answer Tyrell?
Well, I mean, I think that there are two things. You know, one, I'm kind of vicariously humbled by the story that Richard just told, because one of the things I think that history does is provide us with these kinds of moments of humility in comparison to what other people, the consequences and the choices that people had, the dilemmas that people confronted and navigated, and then recognizing how those things tie to our own realities, our own lives. You know, my father wrote his name in a very awkward scrawl. He had a third grade education. That was as far as Black people in Hazelhurst, Georgia were allowed to go. His sister, I later learned, my aunt, learned to read when her daughter went to school. When she would bring her spelling books home. And so her five-year-old daughter had no clue that her mother was learning to read along with her at the same time. And so I think that, you know, when I look at that moment, from that moment to the moment we're in now, you know, where, you know, Heather's book is out and doing well. There, if you look at the bestseller list, which I did the other day, it was about a third of the books on there were by Black writers. Or writers of color, and many of them being topics that dealt with race. And so, you know, to the question that was submitted, I think that very fortunately, we're at a moment where we are flush with information. And so it's not to say that this is perfect or that we've reached the moment in which, you know, we have all that we have strived for has been realized. But I think that now the real thing is to have the will to go out and find it, to go out and look. And it's there for you if you're willing to put in the time to locate it.
May I add something to that?
Yes, of course. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I mean, looping back to this conversation about this moment we're in, where we really do see a politically motivated and well-funded by a lot of extremely wealthy people campaign to ban books, to ban ideas, to ban teaching about this country that is robbing our children. Right. This is one of those issues where the right wing is trying to make a zero sum argument that this incredible curiosity and hunger to reclaim our collective history. This is a political game, but the real victims of this political football are our children, who in 2018, the Southern Poverty Law Center did a survey that found that only 8% of high school seniors in this country could accurately name that our Civil War, that a primary cause of the Civil War was slavery. And so, you know, we have been robbed of our collective history. And the goal there is to keep us vulnerable to the same kinds of manipulations in the present, right? It's this zero-sum story has always been sold for profit by a narrow, self-interested elite who want to keep white, working and middle-class Americans thinking that their greatest enemy is the Black and brown or Asian American person down the street who might take their job or sit next to their kid in school, as opposed to the people who really have the rules, really have the power to write the rules in our society. And so that's really the playbook. And it is leading to a chilling effect in schools across the country. But ultimately, who is most hurt by this? It's not our children, right? Our children are going to learn because we are going to teach them. And it's not even children of color who are going to learn because their parents are often going to make sure. We've had generations of trying to make sure that our children know our history. It is white children who are going to be robbed of their collective history, both the pain and the struggle, and also the overcoming and the resilience.
Before we are out of time, Richard, you made a profoundly affecting documentary called Sky Blossom, which is a raw, candid look at millions of young people who are taking care of injured veterans. And we have a clip of that we'd like to show right now.
Can you come get my legs?
After Chaz got hurt, it was a whole new way of life.
I'm always making sure he's okay and that he's taken care of and that he's always happy.
It's hard for people to understand him. I check on him to make sure that nobody's staring at him. Because a lot of people get bullied and it's not right.
Got it? It's made me have to grow up a little bit faster than I should.
Papa. School will always be there. Grandpa won't. So to lose him would be a lot.
Richard, your interest in this subject, I would imagine, came somewhat out of your own caregiving experience for your father, who suffers from Alzheimer's disease. And the reason we wanted to show that clip was because this is still another area, still another group of people who are being the victims of discrimination, of bias, of bullying. It's all part of the same toxic stew of hatred and racism in a way. I guess my final question to you is, how optimistic are you that we can stop making people of color, LGBTQ people, disabled people, into the other? How can we stop the otherization in this culture?
And Jane, thanks for sharing a bit of Sky Blossom. It took us 5 years to finish that project. What drove me to do it was because there's one value that we've all been talking about, Heather Jelani, as well as you, Jane, and Don, is that we got to learn how to care for people. And this is about how we can make things better. And I'll again put on the journalist hat only for this for the moment, is that we need to talk about stories in intersectional ways, as I think we all have in this discussion today. And I thank you for that, Jane. Is that, you know, when I talk about immigration, I don't only have a face that happens to be Latino or Latina, but also African and also Asian and also of Irish, for instance, which I've done a panel on before. We have to understand that when we talk about immigration, it's just not one flavor. And so in the movie, the five families represent Black, Latino, Native, Asian, and white. It represents the East, the West, the Midwest, the South, and the Pacific Islands. And we don't go to every family and say, hey, here is our Native American family. We don't say this is our Latino American family. We merely say, look at this amazing person, a young person, caring for another person. And through that intersectional approach to storytelling is where we have a power. We have an opportunity to provide the runway to reach some level of racial comedy. And if we can reach that level of racial comedy, and I'll finish with this, then perhaps when we do gather people in our backyard to finish where we start, we will have a very rich backyard, because that's where it's at home. And that's where we have to do this, at home. And for me as a journalist, I try to take it home.
And we'll have to borrow Jelani's refrigerator to be part of that package. I think that would be wise as well. Jelani, do you? I want to just get a word in from you and from Heather, and then we're going to be out of time. But the otherization in America, Jelani, how does that? How do we start to push back and change that?
You know, I mean, I think that we have in this society in a tradition of this that we've talked about. And there's much more that we could talk about here, but there's another tradition that I want to talk about that's kind of on the other side of the zero-sum idea. And that needs to be held up as well. You know, when we've talked about the surge of populism in this country, or what we've been calling populism, you know, we've gone back to talk about, the worst kind of populist impulses and the kind of racialist politics that come out of figures like George Wallace in 1968. And the kind of populism that says anything that you get comes out of my pocket. But there's another kind of equal and important strand to populism in this country. The strand that says that we want everyone to do well. We talk about George Wallace. We don't talk about Henry Wallace, who in 1948 went around the country campaigning on the progressive ticket to black and white crowds, saying that each of you is poor and we want no one to be poor, that people can work together for this. We don't talk about that being the tradition of the Poor People's Campaign that Martin Luther King organized and was organizing toward the end of his life. We don't talk about that being at the very beginning of the Populist Party in this country before it kind of made a turn toward, you know, racial xenophobia and so on. Or this being, you know, people like Reverend William Barber who are doing this work now. And that is the vital tradition that we need to study, that we need to expand upon, that we need to understand, and that we need to enhance and contribute to with the anticipation that we're capable of making a more just and decent and democratic society.
Heather, the final word is going to go to you. You have a 3-year-old son, or is he about to be three, or he is three? Riaz.
He's about to be three, yeah.
Your book has been called stunning and exquisite and brilliant, and it's also been called oddly optimistic. So I guess my question, the final question, the takeaway from this broadcast is, what do you want for Riaz in terms of growing up Black in this country?
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. And thank you so much for the question. I was just really moved by the personal stories that you shared, Richard and Jelani, and I'm just so glad to have been a part of this conversation this afternoon. You know, I want to build on where Jelani left us off. You know, in The Sum of Us, it is oddly hopeful because it's a book about racism that pulls no punches, and that many people who read it say, you know, I feel outraged that I didn't know the extent of the racist history and design of our policymaking. And yet there is hope in every chapter. Because just as I identified the zero sum and the drained pool politics that were costing our country so much, I also identified what I began to call a solidarity dividend that was being fought for in communities across the country. And that's when people come together across lines of race, link arms to unlock these gains that can only be achieved together. Cleaner air, higher wages, better funded schools. It really is about finding our collective action and that power in rejecting being divided by the powers that want to keep the status quo exactly as it is. It really is about rekindling the flames of that kind of cross-racial populist movement, which has been a part of our history, always oppressed and suppressed, sometimes violently, and yet is always there. And that's really the contest right now. Will a multiracial democracy survive and thrive? And I think it will. And I left the journey to write The Sum of Us much more hopeful than I was when I began it. And that's the society I see for my three-year-old son. He's already part of a generation where there's no racial majority. And he has an Asian grandmother, a Black grandmother, a white stepmother. He is really living into the future that we are becoming. And what I hope for him is that he and his peers will finally have a power structure in business and in government that has the values that I see already in him and the generation that is coming into leadership.
Again, speechless, heartfelt thanks to all of you for donating your time and talent today, for your candor, for being so honest, and for everything you're doing to help us unite around social justice. Thanks for joining us today. Until we see you back here next time for Common Ground, I'm Jane Whitney. Take care. I'm your host, Jane Whitney, with heartfelt thanks to you for joining us. Thanks as well to our distinguished guests for helping us to see a complex issue through a different lens as our hope of finding common ground goes on. For more information on this podcast, or to watch the broadcast version of Common Ground, visit ctpublic.org/commonground.